Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. There were many contemporary Western musicians who performed with South African artists, especially as apartheid was winding down in the late 80s.
But musicians like Paul Simon and Peter Gabriel never went to jail for playing with those artists. Johnny Clegg did. Clegg moved to South Africa as a boy in the late 1960s, and he was attracted to the tunes of Zulu street musicians in Johannesburg. That was not legal in those days, but it didn't deter him. In the 1970s, Clegg and Sipho Mchunu formed the band Jaluka, which attracted both black and white audiences, and also the unwanted attention of the security forces.
Clegg's music became, in part, a symbol of what could be in South Africa, and it outlasted apartheid. This week, a new album comes out, and he plays a concert in Chicago, part of a farewell tour for Clegg, who has been suffering from cancer. We reached him at his home in Johannesburg as he prepared to leave for the States. It's a real pleasure. Thank you for taking some time to talk.
Thank you, too.
I want to turn the clock way back, if I can. What did you see in Zulu music and Zulu culture that spoke to you so strongly when you were so young?
I stumbled on Zulu street guitar music when I was 14. And I noticed immediately that the guitar was tuned differently, and then that the finger-picking style was unique, that there were no chords, and it was highly rhythmic, with the thumb playing all the bass notes, and the forefinger playing a melody. And I kind of intuited that this was a unique genre of African guitar music, and I was totally curious and fascinated and wanted to learn it. And it was really through the generosity of a guy who was 10 years my senior, a musician called Charlie Mzila, who was an apartment cleaner. He was a tribesman from Msinga, which is a very famous warlike Zulu district. And he agreed to teach me. That was the portal. That was the moment. It was like the cultural stargate. You know, I just was shifted into a completely different world and reality, landing in migrant labor hostels around Johannesburg, into informal illegal shebeens, speakeasies, selling illegal liquor where guitarists would meet and play. And discovered the hidden world of the Zulu migrant laborer, which became really embedded in my early life and teens, and led me into Zulu war dancing, into stick fighting, into praise poetry, into, you know, obviously the language, the melodies, the rhythms.
But it was something different for you to be able to play Zulu music with, you know, for Charlie to teach you this and for you to be able to play it. When you were 16 or 17, did you look at what you were doing as especially brave?
Not really. I was on a huge, excellent adventure. You know, I was arrested by the police. I had my problems with the authorities. I was arrested for trespassing in private properties where these people were being housed, but where they were dancing or playing music. I got into trouble, but that was all part of, as I saw as a kid, it was just really a price to pay for my entry into this world. I was not a politically conscious adolescent. You know, I did this through the love of the music and for the language. You know, when I first started playing Zulu music, I used to sing it perfectly and with the right intonation, and for the first year I didn't know what I was singing. I mean, that's how crazy it was. Until I there was a song that I learned, and I would play it for a gathering of people at a shebeen or around the hostels in on the weekends, and they would say, play it again, and they would be crying. They would think it's the most fantastic. And I'd play it again, and I was thinking it was a war song or a wedding song or a funny folk tale or something. And they wouldn't let me go on. They'd say, no, play it again. And I would play it again, and they would fall about. And I just got suspicious. anyway, so I decided to buy a dictionary, and I bought a dictionary, and I couldn't find the words. So I worked out, you know, it was a pretty rude song. And when later on I began to speak Zulu fluently, I realized how really rude it was. And I had like a 10-year sort of moment of extreme post-embarrassment.
So really you were self-taught in the Zulu language to a large degree. What do you think made you identify so strongly with it?
As a young person, you know, I'd grown up in three different African countries. I'd been to six schools in 5 years in three different African countries. I was a migrant myself, having been born in England. And then, you know, left when I was 6 months old and growing up in Zimbabwe. So I was also looking for some kind of roots, some kind of permanent idea of what I could be, who I could be. And you know, Zulu culture offered me up some kind of a way to identify with the place I was living in. The Zulus have a very strong identity, you know, it's coded in the language and coded in the body movement. When I saw Zulu war dancing, I just said that there's something there that is just so powerful. I had to learn it.
So you sort of found a home in this culture and with this music, and at the same time, you said this was really separate from politics in those days. At what point did you begin to appreciate?
It was never separate from politics. I never had a political motive or intention. Politics permeated every level of South African society. I mean, it was a racially divided and culturally divided society by law. It is the only country in the history of human civilization that had a constitution that demanded that people be streamed at the moment of birth into one of four races. And once you were streamed, your future was completely determined. It didn't matter whether you were a good or bad person, clever or not. If you were born Indian, you would live amongst the Indians. You had to go to Indian schools. You had to live in an Indian area, ride on an Indian bus. You know, it was that separated. So politics was everywhere. What I'm trying to say is I heard a music through the guitar, which I came to love. I came to love the music just as a natural, intuitive thing. Part of the price to pay was being arrested and harassed and being vilified and all that stuff from white people. And from obviously the police and the security police. I was arrested many times because caretakers of buildings where I was playing with the workers on the top of the rooftop would find me there, and they would call the police, and I'd be arrested for trespassing. So it was a kind of it's a price I had to pay. And as a young person, I was in this world. I had no other frame of reference. And as a young person, I was prepared to pay that price. It was only when I got to university, when I was 19, that I began to look at apartheid from a completely different perspective. I was very street smart. I knew how to get in and out of places. I had to learn that to survive. But then I came to question, why was my behavior being criminalized? Why did I always feel like I had to be a ghost, you know, getting from one place to another? It was like a fence. When I was young, I came to the fence across the road and I thought, there's a fence. Is there a hole in the fence? No. Well, I'll climb over I'll find a way around the fence. When I got to university, I asked the obvious question, Why is there a fence? Why should there be a fence?
What always strikes me about your music, too, is how it seems that your love for Africa shows through, and that's really saying something, because Africa was, or South Africa anyway, at the time you were coming up, was so hard for so many people. Was there ever a point you thought, I don't need this, I'm going to move to Europe or America or someplace where I can and sing with who I want to sing with without having to get over that fence?
That wasn't an option open to me, you know. We were not wealthy. We didn't have the means to relocate anywhere. My mother was born in Zimbabwe. My stepfather was born in Johannesburg. My biological father, I never knew. I had to go look him up when I was 21. And it was the first time I left the country. I managed to get enough money up to buy a ticket and get across to England and meet him and stay with him for a few weeks. And I felt a complete alien in England. It was my land of birth, but I had no cultural connection at all with the English people. I mean, it was a tough working class pub culture, to which I had no connection. So, you know, when I got home to South Africa, you know, it was the devil I knew. I'd worked out ways to get in and out and live the life, however inconvenient, that I loved.
African sky blue, your children wait for the dawn. African sky blue, soon a new day will be born. African sky blue, African sky blue, will you bless my life?
I want to flash forward all the way into the 90s and ask you about, I saw a video of a concert you gave. I think it was in Europe, maybe it was in Germany, when you were playing your song Asimbonanga when Nelson Mandela joined you on stage.
Yeah.
Had you met him before that moment?
Yeah, I had. I'd met him in 1992 on his great, or 91, in his great American, his introduction to America and all the fundraiser. I played at one of his fundraisers in New York. And I'd met him in Paris at a government function when he was released and he went to Paris. I met him in many different formal situations. This was the first time that he came on stage as really in an informal moment. That show was a show that the German government had hosted. It was a symposium of NGOs who were all meeting together to formulate policy in Africa, and Nelson Mandela had been the keynote speaker. We didn't know that. We were touring Germany in 1997, and they had sent a message to our tour manager to say, we know that we haven't booked Johnny Clegg. Is it possible somewhere in the tour, if he could come and do this date, which is the end of the symposium for all the people who participated? And happily we could, and we did. We arrived, we set up, and then we did the show. And, he walked on stage, which was an amazing moment for me, because it was the song I wrote for him 11 years previously. In 1986, during a state of emergency in South Africa, a very dark, dark moment. And as a singer-songwriter, no one, who would ever imagine that 11 years later, he would walk on stage in a foreign country and sing along with me. It's just the universe is such a strange place. And it's the pinnacle as a singer-songwriter. That's the finest moment, of my life.
I was amazed in looking at it at both how comfortable you look in that moment, and secondly, how much he truly seems to be enjoying the song.
You know, people ask me that. What's he like? How, you know, as, you know, and I have to say, you know, he's not my buddy, and he's got a very sort of a Victorian. He grew up in that period of the hangover of the whole sort of Victorian English gentleman politeness and formality. He was very formal. He was never familiar with anybody. I think it was hard for anybody to get close to him because, you know, he had a certain internal composure. He had that incredibly civilized and formal internal composure, and he had an incredible and remarkable ability to listen and make you feel that you were the only thing in his universe at that moment. It was an incredible ability and skill as a communicator that he had.
Where do you see race and racial issues in South Africa today?
Very much like the rest of the world. The nationalism, tribal, sectarian, nationalist, racial and identity politics, all of this is coming to the fore all over the world. It's actually, I think, triggered by the 2007-2008 economic meltdown. And so, you know, in South Africa, it's not just race here. We've had huge problems with xenophobia, attacks on other African communities from Nigeria, from the Congo, from Zimbabwe, by local people who, coming out of that economic downturn. And, you know, it's in any time where there is competition for scarce resources, you have this kind of issue. ANC politicians have raised the issue of what they call white monopoly capital, which is a metaphor for the fact that economic power hasn't been transformed enough for the black majority. The ANC has failed to address other aspects of the economy where they could have made a very, very good impact. So we're in a pretty tough moment in South Africa at the moment. But, you know, if you look at Catalonia in Spain, if you look at Brexit, if you look at Donald Trump's, you know, appeal to people's sensibilities about how America has been sacrificed on the altar of globalization, you know, this is a common theme that's running through many, many places.
So as you prepare to take this trip around the United States as part of this farewell tour, you have been through a lot recently, cancer, a number of surgeries. When Nelson Mandela was on stage with you, he said it was music and dancing that made him at peace with the world. What makes you at peace with the world today?
Exactly that. You know, when I perform, I'm connected to my past, my present, and my future. And I bring with me a deep desire to connect with my audience in that moment or half hour or 2 hours or 3 hours, whatever it is that I'm doing. And this particular show, which is an autobiographical show, it's a farewell show. So it's really a kind of a wrap up, you know, of my 40 years of music.
Well, and they are 40 years that I think the world is truly grateful for.
Thank you, Mitch.
Johnny Clegg speaking with us from South Africa. He plays a show at Park West in Chicago on Sunday. It's part of his farewell tour. His new album, King of Time, comes out on Friday, and this is the title track.
I've been thinking about the way I think about my thinking. I have a feeling that our little boat is sinking. I don't know anymore what it is she sees in me. Maybe the promise of the man I used to be. Somewhere long ago we lost our way. Stop the clock and start again. If I could freeze the sun in the sky, I could go back in time.